but she doesn't love him, Stephen. She admitted it. I found myself telling him about our dreadful quarrel in her bedroom, describing how I crept out of the flat. When I told him I had realized how wrongly I had behaved to Rose, he said, "Don't you worry about that. Rose is bad." I said, "Sometimes we're bad without meaning to be." And then I asked him if he could ever forgive me for letting him kiss me when I knew I was in love with someone else. "Oh, Stephen, that was bad, and I let you go on thinking I might get to love you." I only did for a day or two. I soon saw I was making a fool of myself. But I couldn't make it out. Why you ever let me, I mean. I understand now. Things like that happen when you're in love with the wrong person. Worse things. Things you never forgive yourself for. He was staring straight ahead of him, looking utterly wretched. I said, "Are you miserable because you made love to Leda Fox Cotton? It was her fault, wasn't it? You don't need to blame yourself." "I'll blame myself for as long as I live," he said, then suddenly turned to me. "It's you I love and always will. Oh, Cassandra, are you sure you couldn't ever get to care for me? You liked it when I kissed you. Well, you seemed to. If we could get married..." The glow from the sunrise was on his face. The breeze was blowing his thick, fair hair. He looked desperate and magnificent, more wonderful even than in any of Leda's photographs of him. The vague expression was gone from his eyes. I had a feeling it had gone forever. "I'd work for you, Cassandra. If I'm any good at acting, perhaps we could live in London, a long way from the others. Couldn't I help you through somehow when Simon's married to Rose?" When he said Simon's name, I saw Simon's face. I saw it as it had looked in the corridor off the ballroom, tired and rather pale. My whole heart was so full of Simon that even my pity for Stephen wasn't quite real. It was only something I felt I ought to feel, more from my head than my heart. I cried out, "Oh, please, please stop. I'm so fond of you and so deeply grateful, but I could never marry you. Oh, Stephen, dear, I'm so very sorry." "That's all right," he said, staring in front of him again. "Well, at least we're companions in misfortune," I said. Then Heloise stood up and put her front paws on the parapet between us, and my tears dropped down and made grey spots on her gleaming white head. I am writing this at Father's desk in the gatehouse. It is now 9:30 in the evening. I mean to work at this journal until I wake Thomas at 2:00. Last night he kept this watch and I took the second one. Oh, have we accomplished a miracle? Or done something so terrible that I daren't face thinking about it? Stephen went back to London early on Monday morning. Mr. Stebbins was driving him there, and I guessed Ivy would go too. Ivy is a really nice girl. She is good-looking. Enormous feet, though. Stephen wasn't ready when Mr. Stebbins drove up, and he was so long coming that I went to find out what he was doing. I saw him through the open window of his bedroom, just staring around him. "Perhaps you'll be famous when you see this room again," I said. "I won't be coming back," he said quietly. I said of course he would, but he shook his head. I said, "I'll see you off. But let's say a private goodbye here." I held out my hand, but added, "Please kiss me if you'd like to. I'd like it if you would." But he barely clasped my hand. He never looked back once as they drove along the lane. While I was washing up the breakfast things, I realized that I had no idea where he would be staying. I suppose Rose will know. I wrote to her that morning, saying I had been in the wrong and asking her to forgive me. I must say she took her time about answering, but this afternoon I had a telegram from her which said she would write when she could, and would I please try to understand. She didn't put in anything about forgiving me, but as it was signed, "Your ever-loving Rose," I suppose she has.